Hey, good evening, everyone. Tonight we are broadcasting live, but only with audio. I'm gonna try the Dhammapada again. It's time 1:30. It's actually almost the same as 1:29, so not too much to say. But we're going in order, so. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse 130, which reads as follows. Sambe tasanti tandasa sambe sang jivitang piyang atanang upamangkatwa nahaneya naghatayu. Which is almost the same as the last one. It means all tremble at the rod. But this is what is different is jivitang piyang, life is dear, sabesang, to all. Life is dear to all. And then the same as the last one, atanang upamangkatwa, having made a comparison with oneself, na aneya naghatami. And the story actually is said to be almost the same as the last one. The Buddha laid down two rules. And so in the last story, it's about how he laid down the rule against hitting other monks. A group of six monks who were infamous for their escapades, breaking a lot of rules and being the instigation for establishing many rules. They hit a group of 17 monks who had taken up residence. So this one doesn't say what actually happened, but for some reason or other they were angry at these Sattarasavagiye Bhikkhu, the group of 17 monks. But in this case, it's interesting, the English translation I think gets it wrong. The English translation says they hit them, and then this group of 17 monks held up their fist in response to scare them away. But I don't think that's what the Pali actually says. I can't quite get it for sure, but it certainly doesn't make it clear that it was in response. It appears to say that just like in the last one, where they actually hit the group of 17, in this one, the group of six monks just held up their fists to scare them. And again, the monks screamed. And again, the Buddha heard and asked, what's that scream all about? And someone told him. And he said, Na bhikkhave ito pataya bhikkhuna nama evangatabang. From here on, monks, this is not to be done by monks. Whoever does it has broken the rule. And then he explains it. He says, Bhikkhuna nama yathahang tadeva anyebi dandasa tasanti. Just as I, so others tremble at the rod. Yata cha mai hang tat teva ne sang jivitam piya. Just as to me, so to others life is dear. Knowing this, nyatva evang nyatva. Knowing this, iti nyatva. Paro na parhitabo na ga ghati tabo. Knowing this, one should not strike or kill another. And so this is sort of the, as I already said, this is sort of the Buddhist version of the Golden Rule about doing unto others as they would do unto you. But there's two interesting points that I can talk about for this one. The first is that they haven't actually done anything. You know, they didn't actually harm the other monks. And So often we place a lot of emphasis on the action, you know, when you actually harm someone. And I mean, it's not any deep or esoteric teaching, but it's interesting to remind ourselves that it's not actually the acts itself. It's our own viciousness in the mind. When you raise your hand against someone, even just raising your hand, you know, a lot of abuse is not even physical. It's emotional. It's the fear. And oftentimes it's the fear itself that is more harmful, that the actual bruises, the actual scars heal much easier, much more completely than the mental scars. You know, you hear stories about parents who tell their kids to go get them their belt, right? Go get me my belt. Could you imagine knowing, like when you know what the meaning is, you know, you have to actually go and bring them the weapon they're going to use against you. The trauma. So that's one thing, is remembering, especially for meditation purposes, you know, remembering to focus on our mind states, our intentions. Doesn't matter whether you actually kill or harm someone. It's the viciousness, the cruelty, the lack of compassion, the slavery to anger, you know? Getting lost in our own anger so we can't even see what we're doing. And that's the second thing to point out, is that this isn't just an intellectual exercise where we say, yes, I don't want to be harmed, and therefore it makes sense that I shouldn't harm others. It's not like that. It's the very fact that you don't want to be harmed yourself makes it perverse for you to harm others. And that's what makes it, or that's one way of explaining what makes it karmically active. That when you harm others, it comes back to harm you, and you subject yourself to harm. Because you know in your mind that this is wrong. There's a sense that this is an evil thing. And by evil, I just mean something you wouldn't want to happen to you. And because you know that, when you do it to others, it leaves a scar on your mind. It perverts your very reality, you know, because doing things that you want to happen to you is easy because there's a sense of the goodness of them. You know, this is a good thing to do, so you do it for someone else. Why? Because it's a good thing. Oh, you don't have to feel the other person's happiness. You know that this is something that leads to happiness, so when you do it for them, it makes sense. To do something that causes harm to someone else actually is perverse. Because you know the harm in it. You know that this is an evil thing, and by evil, again, this is a suffering thing, a thing that leads to suffering. So anyone who says that you should try and maximize your own happiness even at the expense of others, or who argues that you know, anyone who says look out for yourself first is being selfish because then they go and harm others, doesn't really understand how it works. You can't be selfish and work for your own benefit. Anyone who is selfish is not working for their own benefit, because they're doing things that they know are wrong. And again, wrong simply means things that lead to suffering. It's wrong because it leads to suffering, and there's no distinction that can be made between the suffering for oneself or the suffering for another, because in your mind there's an awareness, there's an understanding that this is a cause for suffering. There is that. So it necessarily involves anger and involves unwholesome mind states, and leads you to be susceptible to harm yourself. When you harm others, the practical fallout is that you'll be afraid, and you'll put yourself in the situation where you're paranoid about retribution. When you die, it will be an obsession in your mind. It's the kind of thing that comes back to haunt you when you harm the harm you've done to others. And so when you die, you end up with that as part of your rebirth, with that as part of who you are, potentially leading you to hell even, but more likely just to lead you to a situation, an abusive situation. You know, often this is what leads to these cycles of retribution, where one person harms another, then they were both reborn, and the other person, you know, one person is the aggressor, the other is the victim, and it cycles like that. This kind of thing can happen because of the psychology of it. You harm others and you pervert your own situation. There's a sense that that is how karma works. And so, kind of thing that we look into, that we discover through our practice, how these things affect our mind. And so it's not just a pretty saying, yes, don't harm others because you wouldn't want that to happen to you. There actually is some depth to it, that in fact that's very much an intrinsic part of how the mind works. So, anyway, not too much to talk about because it's very similar, but we're continuing on. We've started the 10th chapter. This is verse number 2. So we're on next to number 131. Thank you all for tuning in. Wishing you all the best. Does anyone have any questions? Let me pull up the meditation page. We're just doing audio tonight. The Americans are going to move to Canada after the election. Yeah, it looks kind of scary. But, you know, America's been a scary place for quite some time. America has a very bad history, if you believe what they say, and it's not really hard to believe. Well, it's, you know, pretty clear what the U.S. has done to Central America, South and Central America. Yeah, what they've done around the world, what they've done to the Middle East, why Middle Eastern people really dislike Americans a lot. They have some reason to dislike your country. So you're all welcome in Canada. I mean, from my perspective anyway. But I wouldn't be too concerned. It's not like it's going to get really, really bad right away. I mean, what's great about America is there are people who are young and have a new mindset and appear to be rather empathic. Not empathic, empathetic. Sympathetic, at the very least appear to be fairly global in their thinking, in terms of unprejudiced and so on. Anyway, yeah. Real question. Does consciousness correlate with defilement? If a person's thoughts, speech, and conduct are thoroughly defiled, is that person thoroughly unconscious? A person's thoughts, speech, and conduct, that person is more conscious. No, there's no sense of that. It depends, I guess, what you mean by conscious. If by that you mean mindful, you know, that's usually the word we use to describe someone. But I suppose, you know, but it's kind of more poetic way, or what's the word? Figurative? No, it's not literally, or in an ultimate sense, it's more of a conventional way of speaking. Like the Buddha said, the mindful are as though already dead, and that's really the truth. If you've never meditated before, if you've never really practiced being mindful, it's like going through life asleep. You know? And when you first start to meditate, it's like waking up. It's like a splash of cold water on your face. So the quality of consciousness, from a technical point of view, it's not that you're less conscious, it's that the quality of the consciousness is fairly low for someone who has not meditated. It's very fairly weak, you could say. But it's not less conscious, technically speaking, though in one manner of speaking it is, I think, proper to say. It's possible to say it that way. Spiritually conscious. Yeah, I mean, just generally, I think it's fine to say less conscious, more conscious. Like when, that's how we use the word in English, conscious of what you're doing, you know. Think of a drunk person. A drunk person is not very conscious of what they're doing. They're conscious. And from Buddhist perspective, consciousness is still present. But they may be less conscious. They're certainly less conscientious. Sangha has a question. Can we say that tanha is the liking of the sensation, as upadana is wanting it back? No, tanha and upadana are technically the same thing. Tanha is just craving, and upadana is stronger craving. But see, this is why Paticca Sumuppada, it really gets too much focus, you know. In one sense, people look to it as sort of like, you know, the be-all, end-all of doctrine, when it's not. It's very, fairly conventional in the way it presents things. I mean, it's deep and it's profound and it's important, but it's not the ultimate explanation. The Mahapatthana is. And that, you know, that explanation takes like 400 cartloads of books. But what the Buddha is saying here is that craving leads to clinging. You know, it's just when you want something, you cling to it. But technically, the mind is doing the same thing whether it wants or whether it clings. So it's a conventional manner of speech. There's no difference between dana and upadana, from my understanding, except... And I'm pretty sure this is how the commentary explains it, except in terms of the intensity. So upadana just is more intense. But conventionally, when we talk about it, we talk about craving and clinging. When you crave something, you'll cling to it, right? But the mind that craves and the mind that clings are actually technically the same. It's the same mind. So Paticca Sumuppada is fairly conventional in its presentation. Much of it is ultimate, and it's talking about ultimate realities, but it's not the ultimate explanation. The Abhidhamma is. That's what the Abhidhamma is for. Anyway, so are we? We all caught up. Not too many questions. What am I doing these days? We have a couple of meditators here. I mean, Michael is doing a course, and then Mark from Germany. And Elaine, a local woman, has been coming by. She's coming by again tomorrow morning. She's been quite interested, and she calls me on the phone every so often, which is great. It's nice to have, to be able to help. She's going through some stress. I'm studying Sanskrit, but I'm hoping to, because I've got a Sanskrit class in the fall, I think, so I got to review my 13-year-old knowledge, no, 14, how long ago did I study Sanskrit? Many years ago. But I'm hoping to work with some people to make this, to redo our meditation.sirimangalo.org. Hopefully we can do that soon. This month would be the time. And we can also work on it over the summer. I'm also going back to New York. We're going to visit Bhikkhu Bodhi. I've been corralled into trying to persuade him to come to Canada to give a talk. We'll see how that goes. Never met him, actually, so it'll be nice to go visit. Question. Crossing into Canada from the States. I don't have and can't get a passport. You need a passport, I think. Pretty sure you can get one. Might be difficult, but I think it's your legal right to get one. I mean, I don't know. I would assume. Yeah, in Carmel. There's a monk here who wants to invite him to give a talk, and he wants my help because he invited him once and he refused. So I said, well, you should go see him. And he said, okay, will you come with me? So it looks like I'm going with him. He just called me from Winnipeg. He's a really nice guy, good friend. I think he follows the Lotus Sutra, unfortunately. So it's a little bit disconcerting because, as it turns out, our understanding of Buddhism is quite different, but it doesn't mean we can't be friends. Anyway. That's all for tonight. Have a good night, everyone.